You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 59, 2005's House of Wax, and the multiplex haunted attractions of Dark Castle Entertainment, featuring Ghosts, Nu Metal, sleazy Vincent Price clones, multiple Oscar winners, haunted vessels, haunted junkyards, lament configuration home design, asylums, group showers, murder basements, Jeffrey Combs, sex tapes, psycho twins, killer orphans, genetic rapists, ninjas, Walter Hill, and Mr. Peepers himself, Chris Kattan. Martin.
Yes.
Now that's enter fucking tainment.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man. Behind blue eyes, and no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams, they aren't as empty as my car.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, ready to peruse multiple haunted houses tonight?
Absolutely.
So this is another one of your kind of ideas for an episode. Why did you want to do Dark Castle Entertainment?
Well, it kind of came up a few times. We were just like chatting off mic about movies, and I think we were...
As is our wont to do.
Yeah, that's pretty much all we talk about. It's our entire relationship, but... We were talking about that kind of era of horror films, and I realized that, like, this one is definitely a secret handshake for... A few of them are secret handshakes for friends of mine and my brother, specifically House on Haunted Hill. But then I also think it's a great just, like, microcosm of, like, what we watched in, like, high school. Like, you and me, like, this really runs... The first films run the gamut of, like, freshman year to, like, senior year. And this was kind of considered like a bad era for horror, and you know it was that weird like neo slashers were already kind of dying out and not doing well, and this was like this weird dead zone.
Yeah, because you're almost a half decade from Scream.
Yeah,
so you're still in the metatextual kind of tongue in cheek ironic slashers that are commenting on themselves and the
Valentine
genre
in
general. And you don't really have a whole lot happening kind of outside of that, because even stuff like Lake Placid is a medium hit, we'll say, but even that is kind of campy and commenting on, like, animal attack movies anyway, and it's written by David E. Kelly.
Yeah, it's real tongue-in-cheek.
Super silly. So it's at the time when, like, horror isn't really scary anymore, and nobody really knows how to make it scary. So the guys... Joel Silver, Robert Zemeckis, and, like, the dudes who are essentially behind Tales from the Crypt come out, and they're like, hey, we're going to form Dark Castle Entertainment. We're going to do it as a means of resurrecting the William Castle kind of style of Spookablast horror entertainment, where he, I guess for people who don't know who William Castle is that in the 50s, he was the king of the gimmick. He put stuff out like The Tingler and House on Haunted Hill.
13 Ghosts.
You know, some of these are direct remakes of his original films. Straight Jacket,
which we'll talk about later, too.
Yeah, exactly. With Joan Crawford, correct?
Yep. Well, and then he also ended up, he produced Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, exactly.
And which was
his foray into making not so much legitimate movies, but like,
it's fair. It's
working with like higher minded talent, we'll say.
When that film first came out, I watched this whole documentary about that film, and William Castle was very watched a documentary about him, about his entire history, and like he was kind of heartbroken because the initial reaction to Rosemary's Baby, especially from the church and a lot of viewers, was quite, they hated it, you know, and he didn't get to see it become what it became later on.
The phenomenon and kind of cinematic classic exactly. that it is. Now, kind of taking it back to 1999, where these movies premiere, because you have House on Haunted Hill. That's where it starts, with the first remake of William Castle's original movie. And it comes out in what many consider to be one of the greatest years ever for movies. It's certainly the most formative year for me as a teenager.
Yeah.
So sandwiched in between stuff like Fight Club and Election
Matrix.
And The Matrix which Phantom was also Menace. Produced by Joel Silver,
yep.
is House on Haunted Hill.
But it was a fall to a winter movie. It was the end mm-hmm. of the year. I remember I saw it in like the winter.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, they were trying to position these as like the new seasonal favorites.
Yeah, and they, one of the reasons again I wanted to do this was, you know, my experience for seeing House on Haunted Hill was so formative and amazing. While it hasn't aged well, like at all. I saw it in Fargo, North Dakota with my brother during a blizzard. It was negative 60 degrees outside. We were stuck in his apartment. He was graduating midterm from college, right? And he's like, we got to get out of here and go see a movie. So we go to the mall. What's playing? It might have even been the cheap theater. You know, it was like that late.
Like to $2
one? It was like December, right? And we sat down. We're the only people in the fucking theater. It's like literally like blowing wind outside, freezing cold. And we just had like the best time. And like, I think that what my initial reaction to these films were, and I already was a fan of William Castle. 13 Ghosts in particular was a favorite. I had it on VHS growing up. I got it as a gag gift at a Secret Santa with my parents. And I watched it all the time. And I think that the House on Haunted Hill really, I think, does capture that you are going through a haunted house. I mean, it's just like vignettes. That's all it is. Like there's very little connective tissue. It's quite repetitive, but has some, I think, three or four really good scares and a lot of really lame, generic 1992 heads moving quickly, you know, weird
99.
Sorry, 99. Like the weird movements of the ghosts and things like that.
They're tool videos. Like yeah. that's what it is. It's yeah. like it was the stuff that like were in like Tool videos or Aphex Twin videos or whatever
yeah.
is that like, because this is William Malone who comes in and he's making like, I thought that this was an original thought while I was watching this, is that I was like, oh, this is nu metal horror. That's all this is, because half of these movies contain soundtracks that have like Korn, Limp Bizkit literally wrote a song for Gothica that you were singing to me before we
yeah.
started recording.
Well, it was a remake, but yeah, a cover.
That's what
yeah,
I mean. Yeah, like yeah, they recorded their a cover of yeah. Behind Blue Eyes. And then you have like all the way up to House of Wax, which is our main movie for this episode, is that you have like Deftones early on.
Interpol.
So like these movies were very music based, but unfortunately for me, and me thinking that, you know, I struck gold here, somebody from Vice like a few years ago wrote an appreciation of 13 Ghosts and called this kind of era, particularly the first five movies, which were House on Haunted Hill, 13 Ghosts, Ghost Ship, Gothica, and House of Wax, he called them nu metal horror, which is pretty apt for what it is. But the other thing that they do try to do, at least with the first movie, that, you know, the original films had from William Castle, is that they try to bring back at least somebody who's trying to do a Vincent Price kind of shtick. Only here they have Academy Award winner Jeffrey Rush doing almost like James Woods as Vincent Price. Like it's the, for me, like I don't like House on Haunted Hill. I don't think the 1991 one is very good. I remember not liking it in theaters when I saw it as a teenager. And even revisiting it now as a 41-year-old man, I was like, this is certainly not aged great at all.
No.
But the one thing that has aged great is Jeffrey Rush's performance, because like he's doing a specific thing but that nobody else really rises to who's there. But like this movie also kind of lays out the template for what these films would become, is that it has an absolutely stacked cast.
It's insane.
And the first five of these have insane casts that you're just when, like when we get to Gothica, you sit there and you go, this has fucking Robert Downey Jr. and Halle Berry and Penelope Cruz and Charles S. Dutton. Like, yep. This movie is insane. But like all of these movies kind of have an example of that.
Well, and it's what I noticed watching specifically the first five very close together is they have a house style too.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, like we talked about that with
and it's part of that like horror movie metal music video kind of aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, you look at there's shots out of Ghost Ship, different director than,
because that's Steve Beck, who also does 13 Ghosts. 13
Ghosts, and I want to talk about him when we get to Ghost Ship more.
Not a great director,
but he's got an interesting background.
Yeah, because he kind of does these movies and then he quits more or less.
Well, and I can kind of just say the point now, but like with Ghost Ship, you know, there are some impressive special effects, like for real in it. He was a visual effects guy for Cameron, as was the director of Virus. You have these guys who learn from Cameron and both go on to do these nautical with amazing special effects. I mean, just literally better than they should be, the type of movie they are. Aren't great movies in their own right, but are still like, these guys are like visual effects supervisors. So like their scenes in Ghost Ship, like the kind of resurrection of the dance hall is amazing. Like it's like for that time, God, yeah. It's like, it's a real like kind of almost like a reel for a visual effects supervisor. Like, look what I did, you know? But I think with, you know, there's the style of that really, like you said, Tool video. It's this rundown, rusted, the music, also the type, even like literally down to the plot points, like the plot points of 13 Ghosts matched with House on Haunted Hill. You have this guy who knows what's happening in the place of Chris Kattan, Matthew Lillard, both kind of comedic actors who are like, I want to get out of here. They're building up this suspense. All of them have someone on the inside who's a bad human. So it's like, but also so do William Castle's films. So they're using the template that he set forward, but also, you know, with horror is always a good mirror for like, you know, it's like Bond movies, like what is cool, right? You know, so this is definitely like we talked about with Stephen Hopkins, like talk about a specific time with like, you know, Dennis Leary that would never come again. These films also feel like this weird 4 or 5 year period that we're never going to get again. So it was that, you know, CW actors, the music, the style of music videos that was making its way into horror was all happening there.
Well, and the other thing too is that it was in this dead period that we're sort of describing, and that like they were trying something new, because, and that I think that's also what allowed these movies to exist, is that it was like, okay, no original slashers are really hitting that hard anymore after Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer. And we don't have any real monster movies kind of happening at the time. Although I guess you have The Mummy in 1999, but that's more of a swashbuckling kind of adventure.
Yeah, May adventure movie.
Total like 13-year-old kiddie horror too, if you're going to classify it as horror at all. So like you have this kind of very rough like drought period for the genre. So of course these guys like Joel Silver, Robert Zemeckis rise up with all of this money, and they're like, it's kind of like what happened with Tales from the Crypt in the late 80s and early 90s, is that it was like, okay, cool, well we're gonna take this recognizable, at least to a certain generation, intellectual property, like they did with Tales from the Crypt. You have EC Comics, and we're going to revive it, but we're going to revive it in a modern way that's spooky and bloody and filled with boobs everywhere. We'll get to that in a second. And we're going to just update it for, like, the sensibilities of the audiences that are watching now. And it's going to be hip and cool. That's where, like, the new metal comes in.
Yeah.
You know, because with Tales from the Crypt, as we've kind of already covered with our Demon Knight episode way back when.
Yeah.
Is that you have, like, you know, the Crypt Keeper coming in and he's your Vincent Price. Like, you could almost see... with, like, Jeffrey Rush's performance, like, if this had been an even bigger hit, like, maybe they do. Because there is Return to House on Haunted Hill, but nobody is really involved in that even
kind of
worked
Castle,
on the original. But
it's
back when, like, because we'll cover another one of these, but I believe that's Warner Premiere, too, the direct-to-DVD line that lasted for, like, a year or two. But they also put out Hills Run Red, which is kind of like the bastard cousin to House of Wax. But, like, you can see the thinking behind it is that they're like, we'll do this again, only we'll do it with the William Castle estate and his films and try to bring that back. We'll bring it back for late 90s, early 2000s audiences. And we're going to bring in with, like, House on Haunted Hill, you have Famke Janssen, who was just a Bond villain, what, like 5 years earlier, I want to say?
Four years earlier. Yeah.
Taye Diggs, Chris Kattan.
Allie Larder,
who's in Varsity Blues the same year, I want to say.
So.
That's
that
also 99.
Yeah.
So, like,
Peter Gallagher, yep.
Who's been around in this pre-OC. So, yep. Like... But he'll be in his own kind of CW mega hit show in just a couple years here. So, like, logically, it makes total sense. And, I mean, like, the first movie did pretty well. That's what allows 13 Ghosts to kind of exist. Now, House on Haunted Hill, for me, is like a 2.5-star movie. We're like 13 Ghosts, and this might be a controversial opinion for some, because these are movies that have been... for, I believe, like a generation below us, like Brandon's generation and stuff, like these have kind of been reclaimed as, like, oh, these are the movies, like, we talk about with Secret Handshake films of, like, that they watched at sleepovers, they experienced for the first time on these, like, Warner Brothers DVD, like the Snapcase DVDs that I remember, like, 13 Ghosts came in and stuff. So there is some kind of nostalgic love and reclamation for these films. That said, I think 13 Ghosts is nails on a chalkboard bad. Like, I could barely get through it, despite it having not only Matthew Lillard, who's fucking terrible in this movie,
so
I might
bad.
Add. He's so horrible
Tony
in this.
Tony Shalhoub?
Tony Shalhoub. And F. Murray fucking Abraham, who he's doing. Like, that's the thing is that you could see, too, is that, like, the thinking of, like, as long as we have one character... that is a throwback to, like, a role that Vincent Price would have played. Like, you could see Vincent Price in the F. Murray Abraham role if this had been made 40 years earlier. And, like, 13 Ghosts is a horrid, wretched film that I think, and what a lot of people kind of hold up about it is the production design and, like, Steve Beck's kind of sensibility as a visual effects artist. But even that, to me, I just think this is a very garish, ugly film.
Yeah, it hasn't aged well for me. And, like, when I first saw it, I saw it with my, like, really close group of friends in high school. And this is one of those things, I think it was also, like, a winter movie, you know. I remember, you know.
That sounds
like
right.
Like, February or something like that. I remember, and I would, they didn't like horror as much as I did. I would always drag my friends, Christina and Steven and Lindsay. And they'd be like, all right, Martin's pick. And they fucking hated me for it. And... rewatching this one, I actually rewatched it last year. It had been a while. What's really tough about this movie is, so 13 Ghosts is hands down, like, one of my favorite classic horror films. It just is. Like, it is so nostalgic to me. I've watched it a lot, the William Castle version.
I have no affinity for any of the William Castle movies. Really.
Yeah, and I think that's partly one of the reasons, I chose this too, is, like, I'm very... I saw The Tingler on the big screen with, like, the vibrating seats, you know. I had a friend in this horror class I did in college. He did a whole thing on the gimmicks, you know. And the one they had for 13 Ghosts, which was really cool, I actually watched a version of it once, was everyone got a visor at the theater. And one, it was a visor. It was almost like across, like, Cyclops' visor. And it was like shaped like a ghost. And you had one slit that was red and one slit that was blue, like 3D glasses. And William Castle would do his presentation before these films, and he would say, you know, if you believe in ghosts, look through the red thing, and you could see the ghosts on the screen. If you don't believe in them, you wouldn't see the ghosts. You'd look through the blue. Really, I think a fun gimmick. And they build it, in that film, too, there are the glasses that allow the characters to see the ghosts. They go even further with that, you know, in the remake. And there's moments of, like, cool use of the glasses, which I like. And for me, the scene I actually think is awesome. I think that I love a big fucking killer slasher. The Juggernaut guy is badass. Like the big haunted fucking junkyard, you know, my shit is so me. That 15 minutes is like really cool. But then it doesn't. But the fact of the matter is, two people die in the house. Two.
Everyone yeah, the body is, count is surprisingly low. For
it's just
film.
Being chased, and they're just like constantly hit and slashed. And that's for me, I think, where beyond the garishness you're talking about, it's just a slog. Like they're not getting anywhere. It's literally an hour of them just like constantly going, there's more ghosts. And it just.
Did you see that ghost?
They're not scared enough. And that little kid is really bad too. His son.
So is Rod Digga.
Oh, dude.
It's, the whole it's dynamic weird. Of like her being the nanny for this white family who also moves to this estate after Tony Shalhoub's character inherits it from his wealthy, reclusive uncle who's played by F. Murray Abraham, or is it grandfather? I think it's his uncle, right?
His uncle, yeah.
And so like he Criticus. Inherits this. Yeah. And it's like she tags along with them, and the whole time you're sitting there being like, I don't get this. Why is this happening?
No, it's one of those things where it doesn't feel like it's written by a human being, too. It's one of those films that kind of written by an alien of just like, also like Shannon Elizabeth looks 25 years old and she still lives at home. It's just like a really weird.
She's Tony Shalhoub's daughter.
Yeah, in no way. Yeah.
Yeah. The mom would have to be like smoking hot like Monica Bellucci.
Yeah, and we see her ghost, and she wasn't that fucking hot.
She was not.
She was no Sharon Stone.
Jesus. The other thing, too, about this movie that I had the thought is that, was this at one point like a Hellraiser sequel script? Because it, especially once you get to the twist of the film, is that it's all like, oh, we're gathering all these ghosts to essentially unlock the whole house is like, essentially the lament configuration, kind of the same way that like it is in the Hellraiser bloodlines.
Yeah.
In that
it's like a trap.
It needs it needs that 13th, the titular 13th ghost to essentially unlock the gates to hell. And I was just sitting there watching it being like, man, you know what would make this movie better? Cenobites. If the Cenobites were in this, this would probably be a kick-ass Hellraiser sequel. Instead, it's just a shrill, not very scary haunted house film that I kind of just wanted to be over the whole time.
Well, and I would be totally down for Cenobites. I mean, always. But in this movie,
Cenobites are like the Predator. It's like you could put them into any situation, and you're like My Dinner with Andre, but with Cenobites. Like, imagine how much better that film would
be. Sophie's Choice with Cenobites.
Sophie's Choice, but the daughter is a Cenobite.
I mean, I would watch that. No, but like, you're right.
The Chatterers, played by Meryl Streep.
She could do anything. No,
she really is the actor of her generation.
And you could see, I think what would have really helped this film is, I remember when I first saw it, I was kind of amazed. I mean, it is like, must have been impossible to film this movie. I mean, like,
it's all glass.
It's glass everywhere. The cinematographer must have been in hell. But also, the moving walls, it is, like, pretty impressive, but it's just used to such poor effect, right? But you imagine, like, and I actually like the design of a lot of the ghosts, too. Like, I like, of course, the greaser guy who got in the car accident, you know, the fallen prince, they call him. I like the jackal with the broken out, caged head. I like the juggernaut guy, but it's just, they're so ineffective. Like, they don't kill anybody. Like,
well, it really is. This is the epitome of what at least the first two movies are trying to do is that it feels like an attraction, you know, a theme park. Like if you were to go to this, like there was always when I went to the beach in Delaware every summer as a kid, there was a haunted house on the boardwalk.
Hell yeah.
And like spook house. This is basically that, where it's just like things pop out, but they don't actually hurt you. Like that's what this movie feels like the whole time, is that like the ghosts are there to give you a little jolt and have you like scream and like grab the arm of your girlfriend and boyfriend. But like at the end of the day, you're still walking out of the theater being like, that was a fun time. Let's go get a drink or let's go get a Coke or like whatever, you know?
No, you're right. And it's, well, you think too, like back to the early, while these films are very boob heavy, sexy, and like, and as gory as they can be,
somehow Shannon Elizabeth gets away with no titty.
I know, but like you have the naked killer lady, the naked ghost, but
wasn't into that one.
But it's still, like you said, it still feels of a time, was like a 1950s, 60s, like you said, low stakes. You go home. It's not disturbing on any like extra level of horror. You know, this is not a thing you're gonna be like, I couldn't sleep last night. It's completely, you leave it at the door.
No, it's right? What Sam Raimi tried to achieve too after the original Evil Dead, is that he called them spook-a-blast movies, is that they're supposed to jolt you in your seat and you're supposed to have fun and ride them like a roller coaster.
Well, the height of that, you know, Drag Me to Hell, when he, you know, comes back with all his faculties.
Although Drag Me to Hell is way more mean-spirited than any of these films, and honestly, every other Sam Raimi movie except for the original Evil Dead, probably.
But it's mean-spirited in a Tales from the Crypt way. You know, it's that...
Yeah, it's a morality play.
It's a morality, yeah, which all those are too.
But like, the end of that movie is legitimately fucked up.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
It's so good.
But yeah, but none
of
these...
There are people out there that hate that film.
They're stupid, though.
Yeah, like, they're idiots.
That's a wrong opinion. But no, it, like, I think you're totally right. I mean, these attractions, and you see that in the next film with Ghost Ship. As well, it's the same, but I think Ghost Ship is one of the better of this group, though.
Oh, 100%. Out of the early, like, say the first like trio of Dark Castle movies, this is the best one, and by best I mean this is a 3-star movie.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, first of all, let's talk cast. You got Rob Eldred and fucking Julia Margulies off of ER.
Gabriel Byrne.
Gabriel Byrne. You have
only a couple years after Usual Suspects.
Isaiah Washington, Carl Urban.
Isaiah Washington, who must have had a good relationship with Joel Silver, because I just watched, you're going to laugh
Romy
at me.
Must Die?
No, Exit Wounds.
Oh, he's
in Exit Wounds as Seagal's partner, who helps like investigate the corrupt cops with him.
Oh.
And he's pretty good in it.
He was in Romeo Must Die, too.
Romeo Must Die is also a Joel Silver thing. So, like, they must have had, like, a pretty good working relationship.
He's not working at all anymore.
Nope. Wouldn't you say all that homophobic shit in public?
It's not a good idea.
Especially when you're a member of the cast of Grey's Anatomy, right, when he was doing it? Like,
yep, not a good look.
You're not family-friendly anymore, my friend.
Yeah. But, no, and this film, I think, too, what gives it a leg up over... House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts is they have something to do. The characters have something to do versus just be scared. Like 13 Ghosts in particular is like, they have almost no objective besides like, we're here. What do we do? And in this glass house, like Ghost Ship is like, we got to fix this thing. Oh wait, we found gold. Do we have to fix it? Like, there's actual like narrative beats that help the kind of survival horror thing move along pretty well.
Well, and Ghost Ship has a pretty similar narrative arc to Deep Rising, where it's a bunch of salvage artists who get called in from a distress beacon. They go find
viruses,
a legendary ship.
Yep.
And they try to haul it in. They find basically like almost Nazi gold on it, right?
Maybe.
More or less. Like it might be. But it's like basically a hidden treasure that is probably cursed in one way or another. And they try to bring it in. There's a swashbuckling kind of element to it that makes it feel like kind of high adventure with a bunch of nasty kind of horror elements that come out and attack this crew of people. And the other thing is, like, when you have, like, Carl Urban in your movie and you have Isaiah Washington and you have Gabriel Byrne, like, all these guys are, like, they have really good chemistry together and everything. Like, this movie is just fun because it actually nails that. It's like, it's not just casting names that we like, even though, you know, Jeffrey Rush is having a ton of fun in House on Haunted Hill, and F. Murray Abraham really brings the ham to the ham and cheese sandwich in 13 Ghosts. But, like, you kind of even mentioned, like, Tony Shalhoub and Shannon Elizabeth, just, you might as well just fling oil and water together. It doesn't make any sense. We're here, you actually buy these people as a crew. And also, the other thing, that opening set piece
killer.
Is fucking awesome.
It's an all-timer. People talk about it still. It's like the one thing. It's like, Ghost Ship's all right, but that opening scene is just, it's top five probably of just, like, fucking cold open horror movie.
It's great.
Insane.
The gore is amazing.
It good use of CGI where they need it, you know.
Also, that's what's her face, Emily Browning, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
who would go on to be in Sucker Punch.
She was great in this too. As you know, very young. Another scene that I think is amazing is when you see the history of the gold and the heist.
Yeah, that's really, really good, too.
It is really, really amazingly direct with the music, the kind of new metal music playing. But it's I forgot how cool that scene was. And, like, you see the ferryman, how he's, like, basically played everyone against each other. And also,
that's Desmond
Harrington. Also, a little couple years there, they tried to make him a thing.
Yeah, he was having a moment.
He was in Wrong Turn as well.
He's in Dexter.
He had been in The Messenger, the Luc Besson film. I think he's British, maybe, but not. And then later on, he was in, like, Dark Knight Rises in a bit part. But
never really happened for him.
No, and I don't think he's that great, but I love the pulpy twist of he's the fair, like, literally the ferryman. That's just fucking cool, man. I love that shit, dude.
You know who Desmond Harrington is, or I guess who is the better version of Desmond Harrington who actually did hit? Dan Stevens.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, he's good. He's the good version of Desmond Harrington, a Brit who comes over, is in all these genre movies, but has enough of this weirdo streak that he's able to actually play these characters with a bit of flair, and they're pretty convincing.
And he's a character actor. Like, he's
exactly
really leaning, especially, like, right now. He's like,
he's the best part of Abigail, which is not a very good movie, but he's pretty fun.
I didn't see the new Kong Godzilla, but supposedly he's the best part of that as well. Like, he's just doing a thing.
Well, and he's in that upcoming Tillman Singer movie that Neon's putting out.
Cuckoo. Yeah.
And he gets to even speak German.
But I think this one is, like you said, like, it's a fun, it has more of a swashbuckling element to it. There's some really cool underwater stuff too. A really good death for Carl Urban getting caught in those fucking gears.
Oh yeah.
Like, that was a mean way to die. And some good explosions, like, and again, made by a guy who knows CGI, you know. I think there's some really, really some impressive scenes.
The Shining at Sea stuff is pretty fun.
Dude, it's so The Shining. Everything with, like,
all the Isaiah Washington stuff, yeah, where, like, the lady, the singer basically emerges and starts seducing him. Like, that's straight out of, it might as well be, like, a floating Overlook Hotel.
Yes. Yeah, and then we have Gothica,
which you liked a lot more than I did.
Well,
this is my least favorite of the first five.
Well, and this is what's interesting. When I saw this movie, my brother and I saw it when it came out. We rented it, and we hated it so fucking much. We just thought it was the dumbest shit. And our favorite line we always would quote was, "I don't believe in ghosts, but they believe in me." And we just thought it was the stupidest fucking thing. And it is still a stupid fucking line. So my memory of it is, like, one of the worst films I've ever seen. So I went into this rewatch like, oh my God, this is just going to be garbage. And I was surprised by, it's really flashy.
Matthew Kassovitz.
And Matthew Libatique shooting it. It's got,
oh, that's right.
It's got great production design. I mean, all these production designs are always good in these movies. Like they really go all the town and has that kind of weirdly futuristic, like, kind of Art Deco,
insane asylum thing.
And
the whole group shower sequence is like the, for me, I think that I enjoyed this movie far less than you did.
Yeah.
But I think the group shower scene
with the melted faces.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That's at least the movie's worth one look, or at least the scene on YouTube maybe is worth one look, because that one's legitimately creepy.
No. And I wouldn't say I like this movie. It's definitely, I was really surprised by how competent it was. And I think it's also one of those things where we don't have those types of movies anymore. Not just like the Dark Castle movies, but like this one is definitely that era of trying to be a little bit higher brow horror, trying to like be in the same, I think, like Silence of the Lambs area of like having a cast like that. I mean, these all have good casts, but like you have Oscar winners, multiple Oscar winners in this movie. Now, before they're Oscar winners.
Halle Berry, Penelope Cruz, and Robert Downey Jr. And this is Robert Downey Jr. kind of still in a wilderness period before Iron Man.
Right before Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Right.
Yeah, like the year before.
And you can tell he's trying to come back.
But there's some scenes where he's full RDJ. I mean, he's like talking to her that one time.
Yeah.
And he's doing his really mile a minute talk. So he's bringing it. I liked, I mean, there's the obvious twist of who the killer is.
Oh, yeah.
But it's,
which was my problem with it, because like 10 minutes in, I was like, oh, it's that guy.
Well, I was like, oh, Charles S. Dutton, you know. But I also, I liked the reveal. I mean, I liked the reveal of the kind of like Cold in July, like snuff den. I thought was kind of mean.
Sure.
And I like that. It also had a little bit of 8mm vibe. But it was interesting too, because if you want to think about these as connected to William Castle, and this is a bit later in the cycle, but like
this is his straight jacket,
you know, and yeah. Straight Jacket also was before he went on to do Rosemary's Baby and produce that, this was the late era of Castle where he was trying to do higher brow stuff. And Robert Block wrote Straight Jacket.
Right.
And they had on the posters from the writer of Psycho. He was trying to go for Hitchcock's like level of like, I'm that good too. And Straight Jacket is actually kind of good. Like, I haven't seen
it. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. It's got a nice little twist at the end.
Crawford's out of her mind. And
she's very drunk, but also, and just crazy as fuck in real life, but you also, it's very similar to Gothica, where it was that era of films, even in the 50s and 60s, where you have a star who's been falsely imprisoned, usually a woman, you know, who's like, well, I don't know what I'm doing here, you know.
A snake pit movie.
Yeah, I'm not crazy. It's Shock Corridor. It's, you know, Naked Kiss.
Exactly.
Yeah, kind of thing.
It also carries on. So, like, we were talking about with the first two, where they're straight up haunted house movies. Ghost Ship starts to push the tone of these things away from that a little bit, and it feels a little more, like, exploitation-y, I guess, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. Like, if House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts are the direct adaptation of 50s style haunted house movies, Ghost Ship would feel more at home in the 70s.
Yeah, Death Ship.
With that type. Yeah, it's a surprise that, like, if you made this in the 70s, like, George Kennedy would contractually be obligated to be in it, I think.
He couldn't help but make it better.
And then Gothica feels like a continuation of that, to where, like, it's more exploitation, mystery horror than it is just straight up spook-a-blast horror. Like,
yeah.
This is trying to be, I don't want to say high-minded, but it is in the vein of like Straitjacket, like you were saying. Like, it's going for something not quite prestige-y, but like, you don't put Halle Berry and Penelope Cruz in your movie and get the director of Lehane and the Crimson River if, like, you're not trying to at least elevate your game a little bit, let's say.
Oh, totally.
But the thing that's crazy, this is the biggest hit. Like, far and away, I looked up the box office numbers. This did, like, $59 million in the United States and did a total of right under 150 worldwide. Whoa. Because it was huge overseas. But, I mean, it makes sense if you think about it, because Matthew Kasowitz, French director, and then you have Penelope Cruz, who's huge overseas because of all the Almodovar movies and stuff.
And Halle Berry's an X-Men.
And Halle Berry's an X-Men. So, like, this movie totally makes sense as, like, the crossover that continues the Dark Castle lineage. And then also this starts the trend of, like, they start actually actively recruiting these European filmmakers to come in and make these movies. Because the next one, House of Wax, is made by the king of trash during the 2000s, Jaume Calitzera, who is Spanish, I believe. He was a Spanish director, and he comes over. And, man, he knocks this motherfucker out of the park. Like, I love House of Wax so much, even though it's far too long at 2 hours.
It is. So I hadn't seen it since the theater. And I saw this with my buddy Aaron at the cheap theater as well.
I took my mom to this.
Oh, man. It's, you and I watched it together a couple weeks ago, too. We just popped it on, and I was like, it is a killer slasher. Like you mentioned, it's a tourist trap remake, basically.
Yeah, 100%.
But, again, the production design of this movie, that little town they built, is so fucking cool. Everything in the House of Wax, made of wax.
Yeah.
Mean kills, man. I mean, some mean fucking kills in this movie.
Well, and that's the Calitzera of it all, is that he really, when he wants to bring the violence, which is what he would bring to all those Liam Neeson movies that he would direct, is that, like, he loves very visceral, stylized on-screen violence. And also, like, stuff that's a little cheeky. Like, let's face it, putting a pole through Paris Hilton's head and then filming it through more or less like a sex tape camera. Like, he knows what he's doing there.
Yeah, it's pretty perverse. And again, very much of that time. You know, it was such a wink to, like, that audience.
Well, right down to Brian Van Holt, who was kind of, you want to talk about dudes, like, kind of like Desmond Harrington were having a moment. Like, he was coming off of stuff like SWAT, and he gets to play the killers in this, the twins, and, like, he's having a ton of fun because this has a decent amount of redneck exploitation in its DNA, and he's really playing, like, kind of like the Chuck Connors from Tourist Trap part in this, and he's having a lot of fun doing it. And then when he also plays the psycho twin brother behind the gross, like, melted wax mask, like, this movie's got it all, man.
It's just a killer slasher, too. I mean, it's just straightforward slasher. I love the production design of the basement where he does his wax work.
Yeah, his molding.
It is one of the coolest fucking sets, man. Like, it's so awesome looking. Also, just like, Calitzera can just do set pieces, man. And it's more of an action movie.
Yeah,
it's an action,
especially
slasher.
The last like 30 minutes when the House of Wax actually starts to melt around them. It's amazing.
I can't believe they pulled it off. It's like, it feels like Chekhov's House of Wax. It's like, I want to see that thing fucking melt and what happens.
And surely it does.
They're stuck in the fucking stairs like it's a peanut butter.
Well, and yeah, because that's one of the best effects in the whole thing too, is when it starts to melt and their feet like go into the steps, and it's almost like quicksand and stuff. But this is also to bring it back to Vincent Price. This is a direct adaptation of a Vincent Price movie with the original House of Wax, where his assistant Igor was played by our boy. And apologies to all of those who are expecting a Charles Bronson episode with this, because that's what we promised at the end of our Judgment Night episode. But Charles Buchinski plays Igor, the assistant in the original House of Wax. And I actually went back and rewatched it. It was both as prep for this and for the Charles Bronson episode that's coming up sometime. And like, Bronson's having a lot of fun as basically almost like in a real kind of like Lon Chaney mode.
Yeah, I and that was a 3D movie too.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and that was Andre de Toth.
Yep.
Yeah, another.
It's guy. Pretty good.
Yeah, another guy worked with Randolph Scott. You know, one of our faves. So, No, this movie is like, it really aged well. It actually probably is even better than I remember. I remember seeing the theater and loving it and like being like, what a fun time.
The only downside to it really is the running time. It almost breaks 2 hours long, and no slasher should ever be that long.
Yeah.
Even well,
it takes a while to get going.
Yeah, exactly.
The beginning is really slow.
All the camping stuff and whatever takes forever, but thankfully you have a pretty good collection of teens here because you have Chad Michael Murray, Jared Padalecki,
right before Supernatural, after Gilmore Girls or during Gilmore Girls, and then right before Supernatural.
Yeah, he's kind of in that gray period between like his two huge shows, and then also Elijah Cuthbert at her absolute hottest.
Jesus,
man.
Christ,
like,
dude.
And we were talking off mic about The Girl Next Door and how much we love that movie and frankly just love her in it. Like,
it's a good movie, too.
It's really good.
It's really good, yeah.
Amazing Emile Hirsch performance and Timothy Oliphant performance in that. Like, I really like that movie. Great premise, and also the type of, like, teen sex comedy that you want to talk about movies we don't really get anymore.
Yeah,
I guess you kind of got one with Bottoms and stuff in the last year, but like even that's more of a send up and way more heightened than something like The Girl Next Door.
Yeah, it wears its like
its roots.
It's yeah. Yeah.
It's roots in stuff like Risky Business or Porky.
Yeah, American Pie. Yeah.
Last American Virgin, stuff like that. That would be a great idea for an upcoming episode if we did like a weird teen sex comedy kind of collection.
Well, especially because we got that 4K Risky Business coming out.
Oh, yeah, from Criterion that's coming up soon. So. See, this is where we start planning episodes on air and people just love that type of content.
Hope you all are enjoying this.
Now, we kind of talked about just focusing on that first core group of five movies from Dark Castle, but because we ventured out and continued watching, like there are a couple worth mentioning after House of Wax, because for a while, like you could see the mission statement, and then they kind of, the tone of the movie start to change with Ghost Ship, but even then they're still making them in a certain way. But by House of Wax, these have completely just kind of become their own thing, and Dark Castle becomes more or less a shingle that like Joel Silver starts to like hide some genre projects under, or at least hang them under, because like you just watched Ninja Assassin, which, and that's James McTeague. Who had gone to make V for Vendetta. Was it after V for Vendetta?
Yeah.
And he was like an AD for the Wachowskis, right?
Was he
a VFX guy for the Wachowskis?
It was on set. It was not VFX. I believe it was like camera crew or an AD. But yeah, because he did V for Vendetta, and then he did that, and then he did and a couple other ones as well. Oh, he did The Raven with
with John Cusack, where he plays Edgar Allan Poe, and he's investigating like a string of murders, if I remember correctly. I kind of like that movie.
It looks great too.
It looks great. It's just one of those premises where you're like, what's going on here? Because it's straight up like, and again, my memory is hazy, but like I remember liking the movie because it's like a straight up opium addicted Edgar Allan Poe played by John Cusack, and they're almost doing like a From Hell thing, like how Johnny Depp was like, or like Sleepy Hollow, where they were like investigators in this strange stylized world. And I remember kind of liking The Raven.
It wasn't
like a great movie I'd ride or die for, but you know, for also a programmer,
I haven't thought of it in 10 years.
If we got that movie today, people would freak out about it because it's just not the type of movie that they make anymore. Or if they did, it would go straight to Netflix.
Yeah. But Ninja Assassin, like, I saw it in the theater, and it's gory fun. I found the Blu-ray at the back of my collection. I said, I own that, I think. And I hadn't watched it since I got it. But it is, it's funny. It's literally the types of deaths from the beginning of Ghost Ship with the wire for the whole movie. It's just these CGI heads
just
being
mangling
cut, heads
people.
Being cut in half in weird places, guys being sliced across the legs and then falling forward, like, and their legs are behind them. Some of the CGI is pretty terrible. All CGI blood, like no practical blood, like anywhere.
I remember that being the biggest. I don't. I think I saw this when it came out, but I don't have a huge... I probably was very, very high when I watched it, so I don't have a great memory of it. But I do remember the CGI blood being the main complaint for people, especially like purists, because this is trying to harken back to almost like Shaw Brothers type movies. And it's like all of those are obviously practical and everything, and dudes like squirting from like severed limbs. And here you just kind of have nothing but CGI blood squibs.
Well, and you're not too far after Kill Bill, where there are expectations for the wonders of the Crazy 88, you know?
Right.
And this, though, like, once you kind of, I think, buy into that, like, it's, I really enjoy it. I don't think it's that bad. It's also like, I don't know how you would do it even practically, because he literally kills like 1,000 people in this movie. Like, it is like,
I'm gonna have to borrow this Blu-ray from you.
Oh yeah, we can watch it tonight. I mean, I'd watch it again. It's fun. It's like really, really gory. But again, like you were saying, like it's, I don't, in no way is it feel attached to the original mission statement.
Sure.
Of
well, it's Dark also Castle. Like they put out Walter Hill's Bullet to the Head, which Sylvester Stallone and Jason Momoa, and it's like that the only reason you could imagine that going under Dark Castle is because Silver still attached as a producer and has a great relationship with Stallone, like dating back to the day,
and Hill worked on Tales from the Crypt,
yeah, exactly,
and was a buddy and also worked with Zemeckis on Trespass.
It feels like a thing where it was like, oh, we owe you a favor, man. You're one of our old kind of boys.
Yeah, and it also was a very, for what it was, lower budget movie. You could tell, like, it's not a big movie.
I know a lot of people don't like Bullet to the Head that much, but it still has some of the, at least enough of the old school Walter Hill kind of signifiers that I'd be lying if I didn't say I haven't seen it multiple times.
Oh, I've seen it like 7 times. I think
the axe fight between Momoa and Stallone is like vintage Hill.
It's great. The bayou stuff is cool too. Like
all the jittery editing.
Yeah, the setting is fun. Like the New Orleans and the bayou. Like there's that whole scene of they blow up that giant fucking like boathouse and like. I think it's a fun movie.
It's an old dog movie, but you kind of, I mean, there's a reason why you keep old dogs around forever is because, like, there's a comfort to them.
Yeah, totally.
But there's also, so, there's 3 main horror movies remaining that I really want to talk about. One of which you didn't really get to, which was, and I think is the best of this entire collection, which is Splice. The Vincenzo Natali, Jeanette, almost like Cronenberg riff, where it stars Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley as like a married couple of genetic scientists who are trying to create a new life form, splicing together multiple forms of DNA, finally including humans, so that they can use it to harvest cells from to essentially try to cure diseases, Alzheimer's, diabetes,
like stem yada, cell yada, kind yada. Of thing,
exactly. Yeah. But they end up creating, it's one of the best Cronenberg riffs I've ever seen, because all of Cronenberg's movies, as we've discussed on now multiple Cronenberg episodes, is that they all use the premise and very goopy premises to explore very human ideas. Like, The Brood is very much a movie about divorce and dealing with custody battles for your children.
The Fly is cancer.
The Fly is a relationship drama that involves everything from addiction to cancer to, like, you know, partner euthanasia by the time the movie ends. And you know, Dead Ringers is about the symbiotic relationship between brothers. You know, all of these movies, when you strip away all of the air bladders and latex and goopy effects, like all of Cronenberg's movies are about something very real and soulful that affects human beings. Splice does that, I think, ingeniously, in that if you watch it with a remove, and honestly, like, I remembered liking this movie when I saw it in theaters, and I hadn't really revisited it probably since then. I think I might have watched it on like DVD once. But watching this in my early 40s, like this hit way harder because it's just a movie about wanting to be parents and what that means to each individual inside of a partnership. To where, and also like when you get to all the stuff about Sarah Pauly's mom towards the end, and it's never explicitly kind of laid out before you, but they kind of lay out that like she didn't have the best relationship with her mom might have been abusive, everything, and it's about like, what do we have in our DNA that we might pass on to our children or might affect the ways that we raise our children despite how much we want to fight those pieces of ourselves. And it's just a really good fucking human drama that also just happens to involve an androgynous gene spliced monster that ends up getting fucked by Adrian Brody and then raping Sarah Pauly by the end. Like, this movie is gnarly and gross and weird, and also produced by Guillermo del Toro. And you can see his fingerprints kind of all over it too.
He has that mimic, I imagine.
Very much so.
The bug side and the
And also just like the whole, like, he loves Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And like these two are just a married like bunch of Dr. Frankensteins who are just creating their own monsters. Their monsters just become their children. Like, it's, this is a really tremendous movie, and Vincenzo Natali directs the fuck out of it.
He's so fucking good, dude.
Yeah.
All his work on Hannibal was so amazing.
It's a real visual feast, and like, you can see all the echoes of like Cell, and then also like Hannibal, which would come after this. Like, when Dren, the monster, like grows wings spontaneously in the middle of it, it looks like a scene from Hannibal. Where, like, especially like the Angel Wings episode where the dudes hung from the ceiling and they spread it. Like, there's a very distinct kind of visual style that unifies all of his work.
This shit, man.
Yeah, it's splices. Fuck, it's really fucking good.
It's still one of the movies. I mean, I remember liking it too, but I think it was like I wasn't at the right headspace for it. And I thought I was expecting more of a horror movie. You know,
it's
like a monster movie.
It's one of those movies that like you liked at the time, and then now you watch it and you're like, holy shit, this is aged like fine wine.
Hell yeah.
And then the other two movies is that you have another Jaume Colicero movie with Orphan that has one of the craziest twists of all time. And it's a killer kid movie, but you also have an amazing cast with this one because you have Peter Sarsgaard and you have Vera Farmiga as the two. I guess another movie about wanting to be parents is that two parents who are unable to have children, they adopt a orphan from the Eastern Bloc, and the orphan ends up being a killer kid that has a secret of her own. And man, as far as weirdo movie monsters go, like, Jaume Colicero is two for two with this one because Esther is like a great movie monster.
You see the sequel?
Yeah. Was First it, Kill.
Did he do that too?
No, that's somebody else.
Okay.
But that's also really good. And Julia Stiles is in that one.
And they brought the girl back.
Yeah. To play it again, because it's also like over a decade removed from the first movie.
Yeah.
Both of these films are a lot of fun, but I remember the original Orphan. That was one of the ultimate movies where people were like, don't read anything about this. Just go watch it, because the twist for the movie is fucking bonkers and it really lives up to the hype.
Hell yeah.
And then I guess the final movie is like we already kind of talked about a little bit, but it's sort of like the weird bastard cousin to House of Wax, which is The Hills Run Red, which is almost like,
it's like a Masters of Horror episode is what it feels
like. It feels like a Masters of Horror episode. It has a lot of like Carpenter's cigarette burns 100%. Kind of in it, because it's about a lost horror movie that a kid's trying to make a documentary about and go discover it. Only it's kind of like a exploitation slasher. See, now this is my biggest issue with the movie, is that he goes to like discover this nasty little, and it honestly looks like kind of like The Burning or Friday the 13th or Madman, any of these kind of like lost in the woods teenage slasher
Dawn.
Films. Like Just Before Dawn's a good example too. And like my big complaint with it is that I was like,
this is like a legendary lost movie. I don't like, it just looks like a dime a dozen thing, because this is also like a post Grindhouse film.
Yeah.
Where everybody starts to become obsessed with like trying to replicate the style of like a bygone era. And like, this is obviously supposed to look like it was shot on 16 millimeter, and they throw all these like scratches and stuff in. They do a fake trailer that even has like the throwback, like narrator voice and everything. But when you get to the actual slasher portion of this film and Babyface, the serial killer that's like stalking the woods in it, this movie's pretty brutal and nasty and like just a great straight ahead slasher.
Once he shows up, and he's revolting.
It's gross. Because
when you get close to his face, he for the audience, like the kind of history of the slasher is he'd cut his own face off as a kid.
Which is in the opening credits movie. And they're gross.
It's nasty. You see the kid pull his cheek out and then slice his cheek off.
With scissors.
And then like you see him like it's really a shocking opening. And then you see him like his below the mask, below the baby face mask, is like his jaw. And it's just like torn to shreds. He just has this open maw of a mouth. It looks like the woman's mouth in Halloween 3 when her face blows out in the hotel when the mask goes bad. It's like, it's crazy, man. He's really, really gross. It's really mean. There's some really good makeup effects. Like there's this it's also very Texas Chainsaw, almost like 2, where it's the whole family is bad.
Or Hills Have Eyes.
Hills Have Eyes, yeah. But you have the well, she reminded me a lot of House of Thousand Corpses. She's very similar to the
Sherry Moon Zombie. Yeah, because it also doesn't make a ton of sense, because like she's the only. It's about a, I guess for those needing the plot spelled out for them, it's about a rogue, one hit, not even hit wonder director, one of these guys who's almost like a Charles B. Pierce type, who's out in the woods making movies on his own dime.
Yeah.
With no formal training and just kind of churning it out. And it turns out that this guy's played by Bill Sadler, which is one of the most fun parts of the movie. But like the only surviving member of the cast was his daughter, who was actually in the movie. And she was very young when she was in there, only like 5 or 6. And they go and track her down. And she's now a stripper.
Addicted to heroin.
Also the hottest heroin addict that's ever existed.
She looks great.
Just totally naked the whole movie. And, like, she develops this relationship almost overnight with this young aspiring director who helps her, like, kick heroin. Like, goes through, like, full, like, forced detox with her. And then she leads him out into the woods where they shot the movie and finds her dad. And then all hell breaks loose because the killer's still out there. You find the real secrets behind the movie. And it just all turns into very, like, redneck exploitation, Wrong Turn, Hills Have Eyes style kind of slasher. Now, my big question for this movie is that the only thought that I had, and I hate poking holes in the logic behind these types of films, but my brain couldn't help but go there, is that the whole premise of The Hills Run Red is that it's this legendary lost movie. Nobody could find a print of it, and nobody could ever discover this director, where all they did was get let out by his daughter to the location where they shot the movie, and he has like a cabin out there and shit, and they like find him. And I'm like, really? Nobody could find this dude? They literally just went to where they shot the movie, and he's like, ha ha, I'm here. Now you're part of my crazy, like, decades-long snuff film, I guess, spoiler alert. And you're just, like, watching it being like, nobody else thought of this to just be like, well, I'm going to go to the shooting location. Maybe he's still there. Who knows?
No, it's like, again, Cigarettes Burns is the better version of this, of, like, the more twisty,
it's the artier version, yeah.
Of, like, going all the like or like Ninth Gate, like all the like the twisting and turning.
Ooh, I love Ninth Gate. Yeah. I just rewatched that last year for the first time. A lot of Polanski references on this. Hope we don't get like, canceled. And Johnny Depp references.
His new film's out today.
He has a new film.
Yeah, the Mae Wynn directed it. It's
Oh, is this like the Jean French period piece thing? I'm going to skip this. I'm gonna
never
going
to see that movie.
Never going to watch this movie. Sorry, May Wen. Still love High Tension, though.
I do, yes.
But yeah, I mean, like, this is the gnarlier version that was released by Warner Premiere, which was like their direct-to-DVD line that only lasted like a couple movies and also put out Return to House on Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
But they like
some animated stuff, I think, too. Yeah,
I think so, too. But yeah. I mean, like, this The Hills Run Red is totally worth a look because it's just a nasty three-star little slasher that
81 minutes
also feels like has been kind of forgotten by time at this point. And it has enough like going for it that you wonder why it hasn't been reclaimed. And you're on the 15-year anniversary this year because it's 2009. So it's like you wonder why this is one of those movies that hasn't been reclaimed as kind of like a lost gem.
I think for me, I had never seen it till you told me to watch it. I didn't even know it was a Dark Castle film. It kind of almost isn't, you know. But that there's that era of like late 2000s. There's films like this and like Laid to Rest, Chrome Skull. It's, and I remember looping them all together in my brain.
Sure.
Of these are trying to start these new like slasher franchises, but they're straight to video and they're going to be shit. There's like hundreds of those. And so I guess probably the reason it hasn't is it might got lost in that kind of
that That's fair.
For a lot of people. You know what I mean? Kind of written off.
Because I think I remember just randomly taking it home from Vulcan and throwing it on and being like, oh shit, this is actually pretty good. Like,
again, I
like
it's
this.
A secret. I wouldn't watch it if you didn't tell me to watch it, you know? So I'm glad I did.
See, there you go. We have another secret handshake.
Yes.
You ready to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Questions about 2005's House of Wax, Martin. Top three Dark Castle. Go.
Well, House of Wax, easily, I think, mm-hmm. is number one.
That's right, baby.
And then I would do Ghost Ship.
Oh, okay.
And then I would do... I'm sticking to kind of the early ones. Probably House on Haunted Hill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Splice, House of Wax, Orphan.
Oh.
Those are my three.
That's good. Yeah, it's... I'm thinking of... I've seen Orphan and I've seen Splice. It's been a while. And those are probably better quality movies, but I'm sticking to like my nostalgia, I think.
I mean, Hills Run Red is like a very close number four behind Orphan.
I would agree for me, too. I think just... It's a banger. It's super fun.
Yeah, it's just a nasty little gem. So, remake, series.
I would like to...
It's kind of irrelevant because this is a remake.
Well, I know what I would do. I would do... a new slew of Castle remakes, but in 4DX. That's the only way you can see it. Like, I would try to
bring... Oh, you would go straight with the gimmick.
I would try to bring it back and see if there were legs for that. I don't know if there are, but films made just... Because the whole thing is, like, 4DX is weird because a lot of the films aren't made for it, you know? And I would want to do a full experiential thing. I'd try to also bring back some of the stuff Castle, like, Emergo, where, like... The skeleton would fly across the ceiling, or
right,
or what he did for, I think it was also, I forget which film it was, but it was similar what they did for like Frankenstein, like signing waivers, like if I die of a heart of fear. Another film we didn't talk about was Matinee, which is another love letter to sure. Castle. You know, that was obviously Dante was a fan, but that was like 93, I think. But it also is interesting that there is that I think generation of filmmakers, Dante and Zemeckis and them, obviously grew up on this. They have a lot of nostalgia for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's also like John Landis remaking the Wolfman as an American Werewolf in London.
Exactly.
Like those types, but they were making their own kind of riffs on those monsters in those movies,
yeah,
too.
With their own sense of humor. Yeah. The Howling, yeah, as well.
I think it's hard to talk about these movies in terms of remaking them because so many of them would just go to Netflix now. Like, it would probably be more like a Netflix series that's, like, shepherded by somebody, by, like, Mike Flanagan.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying it out loud, and I would watch all of that.
Yeah.
Now, I guess since we've entered the era where, like, you know, the big debate on saving theaters is that they're now eventizing movies.
Yeah.
You know, like, people don't just go... Although this year, I guess, is kind of like where we have a big, like, movies are back sort of contingent. Like, you even just saw Challengers today for the first time. So, like...
And Fall Guy, just like
this... Fall Guy, yeah. And, like, you know, bringing movie stars back and everything. So, like, maybe this is the time for when you would do, like, a full William Castle-style revival. Is, like, yeah, like, set, you know, weird little... buzzers and like the seats and do like a Tingler remake, or you know, maybe hand out like straight jackets or have somebody in a straight jacket like running through the theater if they do like a remake of something like Homicidal,
yeah,
or like stuff like that. Like, you could see where this is the moment where that might work, because people are just like, dude, if you go to the theater, you never know what the fuck is going to happen when you watch this movie.
Yeah.
And maybe it shocks people out of, like, being on their phone or, like, taking screenshots of the screen as the movie plays. Probably not, but we'll see.
Well, yeah, and it could almost, even not if at a theater, but, like, a short version of some of these at, like, a...
Like a roadshow type,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly, a roadshow or... Or at, like, if Universal had the rights to it, like, at Universal Studios, like, make it part of, like, go see these films. And like, it's a 30-minute version of House on Haunted Hill with crazy new special effects and the William Castle experience kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be pretty fun.
Yeah. Because I think he works best as a ride. And, like, you were saying, like, what these early films, too, were more... He was a huckster. I mean, he was a full-on, like, carnival barker.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things I find, all the ballyhoo, you know, I think it's really charming.
And that just doesn't exist anymore, even in terms of, like, stars promoting movies. Like, one of the best kind of campaigns that we've had recently is you just brought up the Fall Guy, where, like, Ryan Gosling's appearing on, like, every show or, like, even on the red carpet premiere, and dudes are getting, like, yanked out on zip wires or blown up or set on fire, yep, and stuff. Like, they're really committing to the stuntman bit of this movie, and, like, that would be the same kind of showmanship that you would have to employ to bring back these Dark Castle kind of properties in any real meaningful fashion.
Yeah, or if there's also... like mixed media as well, where like augmented reality stuff, if that actually ended up taking off, you know, like augmented reality glasses
for your Apple VR headset.
Yeah, but if it, you know, I think it would work well as a VR experience as well. I'm just thinking outside the box.
Just spitballing.
Yeah, above where
there's also, no bad ideas in a brainstorm.
But also thinking what Castle would be working on if he lived today. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
With that kind of mentality, he would be using new media.
He'd do that. I mean, you went straight to 4DX, and that would be his.
Yeah.
Like his bread and butter.
Yeah, and I would love. I mean, I would love to have him come back and do that.
Double feature.
I'm gonna do Ghost Ship with Event Horizon. Pretty much the same story. Another one, yep. You know, the derelict craft that has a history it went missing years ago. Also, Event Horizon is just one of my favorite movies, like period. And so, any excuse to watch that. But they're almost identical. The same thing with like blowing up. You know, blowing up the other ships you can't get off. You know, a little bit of like it knows your fears, like especially Isaiah Washington, like his character, like you basically know he wants to cheat on his wife and or his girlfriend's fiance, and like he's given the opportunity and he dies pretty much the same way that Kathleen Quinlan dies in Event Horizon. But I'll do that. Or I mean, we talked earlier. I think that Ghost Ship would do well with any nautical horror. Like I think Virus would do really well with it, or Deep Rising, all that like late 90s.
I don't know that I've ever seen Virus.
Ooh, we got to pop that in. I got that on Blu-ray.
Well, we might watch that tonight.
Oh, we're going to watch that tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, it's special.
I'm into that. I would probably do House of Wax with the Friday the 13th remake.
Ooh, that's good.
So you have a Padlecki double feature. They have pretty much the same exact tone.
Yep.
The killers are both really good. Obviously, you have Jason Voorhees in the one. You have kind of like his whole condensed backstory.
Yeah.
You have the first three films kind of made into one remake with the... Because that's 2009?
2009.
And then...
Like the first four films, yeah.
And then House of Wax just rips. It's like its own tourist trap remake. But they're both like kids go camping, lost in the woods, stumble upon a maniac, get their shit fucked up, and they all employ like really great CW stars.
They're both really flashy. Like they're like both like produced.
Yeah, they're like, really like, well made. Because yeah. Marcus Nipsel makes the Friday the 13th remake. You have Jomi Kalitsera making House of Wax. There's a bit more nudity in the Friday the 13th remake, so that really spices it up, because yeah. There's not that much in House of Wax.
No.
But they're both, like, pretty gnarly, nasty, little down-and-dirty horror movies that probably are better than any right that they have to be.
Dude, Friday the 13th, man, like, that, when I saw it in the theater, I went immediately the next day. That's one of the best experiences I've had of the audience losing their fucking minds and screaming and having fun.
Yeah.
It's a full-on midnight movie vibe.
Like, oh, I went and saw the midnight show.
Oh, man.
When that premiered, and I absolutely loved it.
It's, yeah, and it really, like you said, it captures the, my favorite, the early 80s, like, flannel feel, you know, of, like, that kind of very lived-in, almost exploitation vibe, too. To that movie.
Well, and like you also have Padlecki playing basically the brother from Final Chapter.
Yeah, exactly.
Just in the remake.
Yeah, it's for fans. I think it's a really, you know, I know most of fans I know like it of the series.
Face Melter. Yay.
House of Wax?
Yay. Yes.
Yay. I think so.
I think it is too.
Yeah, I
the last 30 minutes are crazy enough that it kind of brings it. So here's my only argument against the Face Melter status, in that I still think the length holds it back and it might take too long to get going to truly earn Face Melter accreditation, let's say. but like the stuff that does rip in the movie completely destroys. It's fucking great.
Well, you and I were like losing our minds having fun watching it. And like, yeah. it had been like almost 20 years, I mean, 19 years since it came out. And I was just sitting there like, this is one of the best horror films I've seen in a while. Just even an older film. It's so fun. It's so gory. When it does get going, it's just, I mean, a real house of horrors too, but in a more effective way. I mean, the kills are brutal. I mean, like, I remember from the film, like, seeing it the first time, like, peeling off the skin of Jared Padalecki is just so fucking nasty.
Oh, it's gross, and it takes parts of his face off with it.
Oh, man. It's just, it's really good. So I would say Face Melter, though.
Well, hell yeah. We got another one added to the collection.
Indeed.
It's been a while, I think.
We've been pretty hard on giving that status, which we should be.
Yeah, it's, I mean, because be Dead Ringers doesn't exactly count as Face Melter.
No, exactly.
Great movie, not a Face Melter.
Yeah.
Well, Martin, this has been great.
Indeed.
Eventually, we will get to Charles Bronson once you start doing your homework.
I know.
But we have something else kind of in the pipeline. I'm not going to say it out loud because I've found that every time we promise one for the next episode, not every time, but a lot of the times when we promise one for the next episode, we totally do like a left turn and go, well, we're going to do something else while we work on that one. But we do have something else kind of cooking up. I hope we get to that next. And I guess a little teaser is that the planet, it's been overrun by animals and they might be apes.
So subtle.
So I know. I'm really good at clues. But we'll have to see you next time for Secret Handshake to see if we hold true to that word. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.